Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa has a new women's creative mentorship project for writers around the world. I'll talk with novelist and mentor Yvonne Andiambo Aurora of Kenya and writer and mentee Paola Silva of Colombia. But first, the Iditarod is the ultimate challenge for a musher with a team of sled dogs.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
And there's our first musher on the trail, Anya Redondo from Talkeetna.
That's from the start of this year's Iditarod. In a few minutes, I'll talk with musher Emily Maxwell about her experience on the trail this year. But first, a different kind of race on the Iditarod Trail. Steve Cannon just became the first Iowan to finish the Iditarod Trail Invitational 1,000-mile race. It's the world's longest winter ultramarathon, and challengers take it on foot or by skis or by bicycle. Steve Cannon is no stranger to challenges. He has run nearly 100 marathons. He was the first person to run around Lake Michigan, the second person to run across Iowa in 11 days. He took on the world's longest kayak race, but the Iditarod Trail Invitational was his biggest challenge to date, and he is here with me now. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Charity. It's so great to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and let's talk about this race. I mean, you did it on your fat bike.
Yes, Black Betty.
When did you first learn about this race?
I first learned about this race, the human-powered version, of course, hearing those dogs bark. I think almost everybody in the world knows the Iditarod
right, proper,
and we did actually get to share some time on the trail with the sled dogs. But I first learned about it doing another race, a qualifying race, and a gentleman named Todd McFadden was in the bus seat in front of me, and he was talking about this race in Alaska. And I instantly became like a child at his grandfather's feet. I was right behind him and leaning more and more over his shoulder and listening to the stories. And immediately the wanderlust and the what ifs and all of that started going.
So what do you think captured your imagination about it? What was it that made you think, oh, I need to do this?
You know, in the last 10, 15 years since I've started doing these challenges, you continue to expand your horizons, your possible, if you will. And Alaska is just this giant place. It's maybe the last frontier. And I had already been bitten by the winter bug severely, but it was still this concept that was way beyond. We were doing these qualifying races, which are 100-mile, hoping, thinking maybe you might do the 350, which we have talked about that we did last year, but the 1,000 was just this moonshot, but still it captivated me.
So once you decided that you were going to do this, I mean, preparing for something like this is such an incredible challenge, and you actually basically moved to Alaska to prepare, right?
Yeah, the race scared the hell out of me. And so 2 years ago, I just started investigating just through the power of social media, just, hey, does anybody know anybody in Fairbanks? I wanted to go to Fairbanks because it is notoriously cold. It's a nasty, ornery place, beautiful, but you're going to get the real cold. You're going to get the real winter. And I just wasn't certain that just doing these qualifying races was going to prepare me for Alaska. So, yeah, I rented a cabin out in the hills a few miles outside of Fairbanks and started no running water, the whole thing is soaking up, and found some great mentors, people that I had known that had done these races, and they were kind enough to take me under their wing, and that started it 2 years ago.
What, give me an idea of how exclusive the club is of people who have finished this race. I mean, there aren't that many who have accomplished this 1,000-mile goal.
So I was curious as well, and so I had emailed the race directors. At some point, I'll unpack all this and write another book, and so I wanted to do a little bit of my own homework. And so the human-powered race started in 2002, and if my math is right, before the start of this year's race, 45 people in the 17 years, I think that is, had completed it one way or another. So, yeah, it's not a big club.
No. And the fat bike culture has really grown in recent years. If you're not familiar with it, these are big fat tires on bicycles that allow you to ride in snow, on ice, in sand, that kind of thing. How long have people been riding fat bikes up there since it started in 2002, or is that a more recent addition?
It's really impressive that you know that. Not surprising, because you always your breadth of knowledge, it just always amazes me. But it's interesting, because if you look back in the early years, you'll actually see that people would complete this on just what we would know as just a mountain bike, much thinner tires, which I can hardly imagine. And then people being inventive would take two mountain bike tires and figure a way to put them together so you would get a wider tire. The idea being, the wider the tire, then you can, you know, you get more purchase. You're able to roll over the terrain that's not so great, all the way to what we now know as these fat tire bikes, which allow you, when conditions get crappy, which they certainly did this year, to continue to let less and less air out of the tires, and you can really ride on things that would surprise a lot of people. But it's certainly, you know, everything up there, because they have winter and all of that, it's caught on quicker there and has a longer history there than here. But you see them everywhere now.
Yeah, I see them in Iowa City all the time.
Yeah.
When you were training, what do you think you did that really prepared you for this challenge? Because, again, I mean, it's hard to describe this race, really, so that we can wrap our minds around it, because it's 1,000 miles and you're really out there on your own. What do you think prepared you for this?
Again, it's a great question. Everyone that shows up to that starting line is physically fit enough to accomplish the task. Especially with the 1,000 miles, it is the mental challenge that will determine whether or not you make it or not. And so if there was any one thing, it was just getting comfortable in a place that shows you just how vulnerable you are. A place that is so big that you realize at any moment, like a flea on a dog's back, it could just flick you off. And so I can still remember very vividly the first time Kevin Breitenbach took me on a ride up into the White Mountains. And I've been in some pretty decent, sizable places, but I can remember putting my foot down and just, even to this day, after 2+ years being there, there's certain times that you look around, and at least with me, I still can't grasp how big it is. And that can be really mentally overwhelming, to where, you know, whether it's a storm that comes out of nowhere, or it's supposed to be 10 degrees tonight and now it's 27 below, and you're in this place, and like you said, especially after the first couple of days, it gets really spread out. So you do know there's other competitors on the trail. But when you don't see them and you're the only one on a river and it's 27 below and the wind is whipping and you can't really see more than 100 feet in front of you, that part is the single biggest, being able to say, I've been here, I'm really scared, but I've been here before and I know my place here. I know how to handle this. That was certainly the biggest thing that being there for these 2 years helped me with.
It's a 1,000-mile race with a time limit. You have to finish in 30 days. So when you set out, how did you make a plan to accomplish that 1,000 miles in 30 days? How were you able to break it up in your mind into accomplishable chunks?
I came up with a team of 26 Steves. And each day I unpacked the Steve I needed for that day. And his only job was to be perfect for that day, whether it be having to push my bike and being able to say, this Steve trained specifically for this. He won't break if he has to push his bike for 20 hours. And at the end of the day, that Steve would essentially go to sleep and he would hand the baton to the next day's Steve. And that allowed me to stay centered in the day. It allowed me to not get caught up in the fact that I had 25 more days or 14 more days. And it also allowed me, when times got really, really hard, to say, okay, if you're going to quit, you have to pick up your phone and you have to call the 13 Steves before and tell them thanks for all of their effort, but it's too hard now and I'm going to quit. And that was just something that was unpalatable. And when it got really tough, I'd take it all the way back. Like, all right, if you're going to pack it in, you call the Steve that left all his friends and family behind and lived in a cabin for 3 months and you tell him thanks, but his effort was all in vain. Or you call Gnome Steve, who's waiting at the finish line, who's trained his whole last 4 years for that last day to cross that finish line, and tell him, you're not coming. And so that was it. It was the 26 Steves.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to ultra adventure athlete Steve Cannon of Des Moines. This year, he became the first Iowan to finish the Iditarod Trail Invitational 1,000-mile race. He did it on a fat bike. You can find out more about his adventures and the books he's written about his previous adventures at expandyourpossible.com. Coming up in just a moment, we'll also talk with Iowan native and musher Emily Maxwell, who competed in her second Iditarod this year. And then later in the hour, we'll find out about the new mentorship program with the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, we're talking about the Iditarod. Of course, most of us know about the sled dog race, the iconic Iditarod. And in just a moment, I will talk with musher Emily Maxwell, who competed in her second Iditarod this year. Right now, my guest is Steve Cannon, who became the first Iowan to finish the Iditarod Trail Invitational 1,000-mile race. He did it on a fat bike. And Steve, what kind of support do you have on that 1,000 miles? Just before the break, we were talking about, you know, how you needed to dig deep every single day to make it through these extraordinary conditions on this incredibly rugged trail in the middle of nowhere all by yourself. Was there support? What kind of safety net did you have?
It's interesting because in all of the qualifying races, they have very extensive gear lists. In the Iditarod, they have no gear list. So the only required piece of equipment is a spot tracker. And that allows people at home all over the world to follow your blue dot. I carry a satellite phone, so that is my out if I need it. But other than that, there is no other support. You carry everything that you need on your mode of transportation, whether it be a sled you're pulling or skiing or on your bike. You don't use a sled, so your space is limited, but you look like the Beverly Hillbillies, right? You got everything loaded onto that, your sleeping gear, your food, your water, your cooking gear, so that when you run out of water, you boil snow to make more water. And then a couple weeks before the race, you send these 5-pound mail anything boxes from the United States Post Office to the villages that you will arrive in during the event. And it's spring break, typically, when you're on there. So these villages have schools. And so either at the school or the post office, your box would be waiting for you. And that would be where you would resupply for the next 12 to 48 hours. And you'd go from village to village and do what it took to try to keep some pounds on you, which I didn't do such a great job, but it wasn't for lack of effort.
So you literally couldn't eat enough to get the calories you needed.
I couldn't. My goal was somewhere around 6,000 to 6,500 calories a day. And with the freeze-dried meals and just the effort put out and those kind of things, I did a rough estimate that I probably was about 2,000 calories short, which put me 52,000 calories in the hole by the time I finished. And somebody much smarter than me kind of backed those numbers and messed around. And they're like, you actually guessed pretty close. If you lost close to 20 pounds on the trail, that would have been about the deficit you had. So, yeah. So not a whole lot of support.
Tell me about the most difficult moment on the trail.
It's difficult to comprehend this because you would think that there would be no way. But I came really close to pulling my satellite phone out 45 miles from the finish. There was a storm in a notoriously nasty area called the Topcock Hills. And it just spooked me. It wasn't terribly cold, but the wind was whipping. At times you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And the trail is marked with these wood stakes with a little reflective tape on them. And they're somewhere around 100 to 150 feet apart. And so there would be times you'd get to a stake and I'd have to just wait for the wind to just subside enough so I could see the stake next. And I would, you know, and you're thinking, this section was 14 miles. And you're thinking, wow, there's got to be 1,000 of those stakes. And, but I was able to, again, as we talked before, being in Alaska, I was able to quiet my mind and see what's real. And I wasn't going to freeze to death. And granted, I couldn't see, but I knew if I kept going one stake at a time, eventually there'd be more stakes behind me than ahead of me. And you just kept moving. You just kept putting one foot in front of the other. And fast forwarding, eventually looking over my left shoulder and thinking for the first time I was seeing blue sky and realizing it was the Bering Sea and I'd made it. And I'd, barring any kind of really huge bike malfunction or anything, the next day was 28 miles to Nome. And I wouldn't allow myself to think I was actually home free, but the most desperate moment was followed by one of the most euphoric.
I'm sure there are people who listen to this who think, oh, wow, I'd love to have an adventure like that. I think there are maybe more people who listen to you and think, why would anyone do that to themselves? So now that you're done, now that you've accomplished this goal, what does it mean? Why do you think it was so important for you to do this?
There's nothing extraordinary in my makeup. I'm just a small town Iowa kid from Mediapolis, population 1,200. What it means is that any of us can accomplish anything that we set our mind to. And if that means getting off the couch for the first time in many, many years and setting out to do your first 5K or deciding you want to be the best parent in the world and you're going to dedicate to walking your kid to school every morning or whatever your goal is, all of those, to me, are every bit as daunting and as important as going 1,000 miles to Nome. My first 5K was incredibly scary. I was surrounded by all these people in Colorado, incredibly fit, and I had never run a 5K in my life, and it felt like it almost killed me. And so this is just an extension of that, but no more greater than anybody that's listening to this, their Iditarod. What is their Iditarod? And so for me, the meaning is that I'm learning what I'm capable of. And maybe through taking that journey and lucky enough to talk with people like you, somebody else decides to find their Iditarod, whatever that is, whatever size it is. If it's a stretch for them, it's every bit as big. And I can't wait to see what's next.
I'm talking with Steve Cannon. He became the first Iowan to finish the Iditarod Trail Invitational 1,000-mile race by bicycle. You can find out more about his adventures and also his fundraising efforts for those fighting cancer on his website, expandyourpossible.com. And Steve, I want you to stay with us, but I want to bring another Iditarod athlete into the conversation now. Iowa native and musher Emily Maxwell competed in her second Iditarod this year. Last year, she placed 33rd out of the 67 mushers who started. And this year, she ran with a very young team of dogs. She knew she wouldn't be competitive, but the punishing conditions forced her to pull out of the race about halfway through, and she is on the line with me now. Hello, Emily.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And first of all, tell me a little bit about this team. You were running with what's called a puppy team, right?
Correct. Yeah. So they're, you know, between 1 and 2 years old. So it's their first experience running on the race. So like you said, you know, I knew from the start that, you know, we're not trying to set any records or anything. You just go and you really focus just on their happiness and certainly on their well-being as you would with any team, but just taking it really easy so that they have such a great experience that first time that when they come back, you know, when they're older, they remember it as this really fun time. And, you know, when they're older, you might push them to compete a little bit more.
And so heading out with this puppy team, what was your goal?
Really, just to make it to Nome. A long story short, I had only worked with the team that I ran for about 2 weeks, which is incredibly short. The last year when I ran my rookie year, the team that I ran with, I'd run them for 2 years. So, you know, we knew each other very well. So that was another challenge this year, was running a team that, you know, I'd worked with them constantly for those 2 weeks, of course, and really built that relationship as much as I could. But that's also a challenge to not be as close as I was with the team, you know, the previous year.
Absolutely. And as you went out with these dogs, you had a rule that you would allow them to rest and you would rest as long as you had been running or moving forward, right? Explain that to me.
Yeah, so we call it a 50-50 run-rest schedule. So basically, however long the run you've just done was, you rest that same amount of time. So if the last run took you 8 hours, you get to a checkpoint or to wherever you're planning your rest, and you rest 8 hours there. If it's a five-hour run, you rest 5 hours. So I actually really, you know, as far as being a human, we kind of enjoyed it this year compared to last year, because last year is, you know, running at a little more competitive rate, but you know, it was nice to have like 8 hours to be able to, you know, you, when you're working on the dogs, it takes a long time. You know, you're working on their feet, you're feeding them, you're massaging, so you know, in an 8 hour rest, you'll probably work with them for like half of that, you know, 4 hours. So that's 4 hours that you can actually go in, eat, lie down, and get some rest. So I was a lot more well rested on this year's race.
Steve and I were just talking about how on his race there was little to no support. Tell me about the support for mushers. How you have check-in points. How much support do you have on the trail?
I mean, out on the trail, you know, you have your tracker just like they do for the invitational. You have your spot tracker. So, you know, people at home and on the race, they can see exactly where you're at. So in between the checkpoints, you know, you're just your own entity. There's nobody out there really to as any sort of support. And at the checkpoints, you know, there's about 20 checkpoints on this route. And so you pull into a checkpoint, you know, that's where you can say like, oh, I'd like vets to look at this dog. When you pull into a checkpoint, they, you know, they have a huge vet team at every checkpoint to look over every dog that comes in, you know, but if you need to leave a dog behind, you know, that's maybe tired or just doesn't want to keep going, you can leave them there. You have your what we call our drop bags. So just like with Steve, you know, you send your supplies out ahead of time. So those are all ready and waiting for you when you pull into the checkpoint. And then normally, you know, there's some food. There's usually a place to sleep. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, a Holiday Inn. Sometimes it's like a shed and you just go in and lie down, and hopefully there's maybe like a little wood stove or something to be warm. But yeah, so at the checkpoints, there's, you know, there's enough support that you can kind of reset, recharge.
So the Iditarod is always incredibly challenging, just on the basis of the terrain, on the basis of the weather. It's designed to be incredibly challenging. What made this year, other than running with a puppy team, what made it particularly challenging?
So the trail was really, really different this year compared to last year. Of course, there's two different routes, so it alternates, although this year we, just because of the way things have worked out in the last 5-10 years with the race, we did the same route this year. So I thought, oh, I know the trail really well. But with that different weather, we just have such a different trail. Last year we had tons and tons of snow. So last year the challenge was actually that it slowed you down a lot. We had so much snow. But this year, in a lot of spots, and I'm sure Steve can tell you this too, there was a lot of points where we had no snow, where, you know, we're mushing on dirt and rocks, which of course the sled really isn't designed to go through. So that was super challenging. And a lot of like huge expanses of open, just glare, what we call glare ice. So like, I mean, at different points, a mile's worth of just straight ice, which, you know, I'd be on my brake to go really slow and go really steady so that the dogs can keep their footing. So there's a lot of challenge, a lot of open water crossings, which my team, you know, my team last year, we had a few water crossings and they flew through them so fast. Like I was almost airborne on the sled. And the team I had this year, you know, it took a lot of coaxing, and I actually, you know, a few times would have to go up and grab hold behind the leaders and like walk them across. And there were even a few dogs that were so scared of the water, I'd like unhook them and like carry them over my shoulder across the water and rehook them on the other side. So, you know, it was definitely a different kind of trail this year than last year.
Tell me about the tussocks that you encountered. These were what, clumps of long grasses? Describe it for me.
Right. So they're these big clumps of grass that they grow really hard, and they're about the size of a basketball, or like half a basketball. So, and you know, they're not consistent. They're not like smooth or anything, or right next to each other. There'll be like gaps in between them. So it's kind of like running through a minefield, you know, super uneven, sort of treacherous terrain. And when I was leaving the checkpoint of Ophir and running to Iditarod, which is the halfway point of the race, and that's about an 80-mile run. They had told me, you know, there's some tussocks going into Iditarod, which, you know, in race speak and musher speak, that sounded like, okay, we're going to have a few miles of tussocks before Iditarod. And, you know, we stopped about halfway through that run, so about 40, 45 miles in. I didn't know everything was fine up to that point. And then we go for the second half of the run, and the tussocks were probably – they probably started about 30 miles before the next checkpoint, you know, and there was no snow. And so we're on grass, you know, and it's like being with a sled, I thought of it as trying to like ice skate through grass, basically with the sled. It was just so much resistance. And so I spent most of those 30 miles, like jumping off the sled, like, you know, obviously holding onto the handlebar, but running to push it just because there was so much resistance and so much weight that it was really hard on them. So I'm running as much as I could, and then I jump back on the sled, try to catch my breath, and then keep running. And of course, you know, I'm wearing what we call bunny boots, which, you know, are probably close to 8 pounds a piece on each foot, you know, and running and running. And, you know, one of my main leaders, she was really small. She's just very petite built. She's probably about 35 pounds. Her name was Flame. And she, you know, she's so short that she's almost like in between the tussocks, like kind of like a little maze through them. So it was getting really, really challenging.
Wow. And we're almost out of time, Emily. As Steve is listening to you talk about this was also really one of the most challenging parts of the trail for you too, Steve, right? I mean, you ended up walking your bike through these tussocks.
Yeah, it's it's like probably the same with Emily. You talk about it, you just start to get like these cold sweats almost. It was like nothing I've ever had to take my bike through. And how you got your sled through that, Emily, when I got into Iditarod, I thought the dog race has got to be over. There's just no way anybody with a dog team is going to freaking get through that.
Yeah. And Emily, that is what did you in. You had to call in. Do you think there's a future Iditarod for you?
Yeah. It's getting pretty challenging financially to keep up with it. So I'm actually looking at investing in my own land and maybe getting some of my own dogs instead of running other people's dogs.
We will check in again in the future. Musher Emily Maxwell, she took her second Iditarod challenge this year, and ultra athlete Steve Cannon. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The International Writing Program at the University of Iowa has found a new way to inspire and support emerging writers around the world. This year, in collaboration with the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, they've launched the Women's Creative Mentorship Project, connecting young and emerging women writers with those with more established careers. And with me now are two women participating in the program, one as a mentor, one as a mentee, although they are not paired up in this program. First up, Yvonne Athiambo Awor, a novelist and essayist from Kenya, author of Dust and The Dragonfly Sea. She was an International Writing Program fall resident in 2005 and is a mentor in the program, on the line with us from Germany. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello, Charity. Yvonne here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And for people who aren't familiar with your work, as I mentioned, you just published your second novel, The Dragonfly Sea. Tell us a little bit about what you write about.
What can one say? I guess I write about humans misbehaving and trying to make sense of their place in the world. Latter book, The Dragonfly Sea, is a coming-of-age story, a little girl off the coast of Kenya making her way through the world, trying to find home. Those kind of themes, memory, desire, belonging, and what nations actually mean in this time of life in the world.
I mentioned that you were a part of the International Writing Program Fall Residency in 2005. What did participating in that program allow you to do?
I'm one of the anomalies, because I was there in 2005 and also in 2017. I was fortunate that it happened twice for me for different reasons. But the first time, what it did for me was kind of allow me to feel a little more legitimate as a writer. I came to writing rather late, having done a whole lot of other things, and then encountering a whole world of others who are in the literary world. It was a kind of a gathering of the tribe and understanding that actually one is not so strange, one is not so alone. It was absolutely amazing for me.
When you learned about this new project, the Creative Mentorship Project, what was your response?
Oh, yeah, it was a kind of yes, because the IWP has been a kind of a space of mentorship for me. And I am very enthusiastic about drawing others into the world of literature and the world of writing, and especially, I guess, women who tend to create more excuses about not doing the thing that they probably want to do. That was very much me. It took a long, long time to allow myself to immerse myself in the world of writing. And that would not have been possible without, you know, the guardians and mentors on the way. So I wanted to be that. It's such a privilege to be able to do that and be that.
Because you were fighting the pull of all of the other obligations of your everyday life, and did you feel like writing, pursuing that, was taking you away from that?
Yeah, at first, and I guess I said a lack of confidence. Growing up in the part of in the Kenya that was then, I think it's a little easier for the new generation. The kind of the good work was either you're rising in the corporate world, which is what was happening for me, or you're a lawyer, an engineer, doctor. The idea of a career and a life in the arts was imagined as a path to penury and desperation. So even though even when I was in school, I was good at, it had never crossed my mind that one could actually make a life out of the thing that one loved. It took such a long, long time to get there, to discard my fear and to run into the kind of people that would say, okay, we're not saying it's going to be easy, but please go on, please try, please do it, please, yeah. The kind of, the cheerleaders that one needs are on the way.
So tell me about the woman that you are mentoring. Who is your partner in this?
I've got two amazing women. I've got both happen to be from Kenya. First is Sarah Ochwada, who is, strangely enough, both of them are lawyers. Both of them are trained lawyers. Sarah is a practicing lawyer, Sarah Ochwada. She's, I think, one of Kenya's only, one of Kenya's very few sports and entertainment lawyer, and doing amazing work in sports law. But she's such an artist, had a passion for music, for singing, for dance and for singing and also for writing. But again, falling, I guess her family fell into that kind of the Kenya idea of, yes, right, but do the real, your real job is to become a lawyer, to do all these kind of things. But I think she's reached the space and the place where she wants to venture into, exploring that part of herself. And I'm so glad that I can be a part of that story.
Well,
the second one is, go on.
No, go ahead. Tell us about her.
Okay. The other one is Stephanie Wanga. I met Stephanie, and again, I had no idea that she was going to be chosen for this project. But I first ran into Stephanie when I was doing a public presentation in Nairobi. And this young woman comes to me after the session and says, I'm going to drop out of law school and I'm going to write because that's all I want to do. I want to write. I kind of panicked because I imagined her mother calling me up to say, what have you done to my beloved child? Okay, let's have a chat. Please don't drop out of law.
But that hasn't happened, right?
No, well, she finished. She did. She kind of hung in there and got her degree, got her law degree. Then she contacted me and said, the day she forgot it, she said, Yvonne, as I promised you, I've done my degree, and now I want to write. And which has kind of gone on to do amazing things. She's in SOAS in London right now, specializing in a kind of field around African studies, but embedded her own practice is going to be built around writing and literature. So I hope I can be of use and of value to these both of these truly amazing women. And the world's going to hear a lot more from them. They're absolutely amazing.
Well, stay with us. We'll talk a little bit more about your relationship and your role as a mentor in a moment. I'm talking with Yvonne Athiamo Awor, novelist and essayist from Kenya, author of Dust and also The Dragonfly Sea. She is a mentor now in this new program from the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, the Women's Creative Mentorship Project. I want to bring a mentee into the conversation, not one of Yvonne's mentees, but Paola Silva is a mentee in the program. She's with us on the line from Colombia. She is a curator and contemporary art critic who on two occasions has been a finalist for the National Art Criticism Award. And she's currently writing a memoir about some of her very difficult life experiences as a survivor of abuse and as a single mother. Paola, hello.
Hi, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And I just mentioned you're working on a memoir about your life, taking on some very, very difficult subject matter. Is that it seems to me that that takes a lot of courage to open yourself up and write about these experiences. Is that one of your greatest challenges as you explore this world of writing?
It definitely is. I mean, before I got into the program, I think I was just trying it on. So maybe writing it in a half-hearted attempt to put all the pain outside of me. But now I'm in the program and I'm doing it seriously. And during the last month, every time I've sat down to write, I've had to sit down and sob for a solid hour after every session, because I am basically recreating everything that happened, every smell, the quality of the light, what everyone was wearing, what was said, but mostly the fear that I felt and the pain that I felt.
How did you get involved in this program?
Well, that was actually a very, very lucky circumstance for me. I had seen my mentor, Pilar Quintana, speak at the launch of the Hay Festival in Cartagena, and I was immediately in awe of her. And
she's a very well-known novelist in Colombia, right?
She is a very well-known novelist, extremely talented, and she also writes about really difficult things. I mean, her writing basically left me shattered and so inspired. And one day I just went onto Twitter, and the first thing that popped on my screen was a tweet from her announcing the program. And at that time, I had been saying that I was going to write for about a year, and I had written probably 800 words and stopped. And I thought, okay, so I will not get into this, obviously. So I'll just assume that this is an external deadline for me to write a first chapter. And that was all it was. So I sat down and I wrote it and I submitted it. And, 2 months later, I got an email, and I just couldn't believe it. I was flabbergasted. But basically, my involvement in the program came from admiring Pilar and just thinking how lucky would it be if she were able to read a paragraph that I wrote and give me feedback.
But you were chosen for the program. How did you react when you found that out?
I still have trouble believing it, you know. I called my partner. He was the first person I called, and I called my parents. And I hadn't even told my parents that I was writing, because this is actually also difficult for them, especially my mom. She suffers a lot, and she suffered a lot through this story. And actually putting it into, ink and paper brings another whole dimension into this. So I had kept this hidden from them. So I had to call them and say, well, listen, first, you need to know that I wrote something. And second, you need to know that I got selected for this program. And they were just unbelieving. You did what? You got into what? Can you please explain? I got into a similar situation when we were in Portland for the conference. Because I got to meet Ariel Levy, who's one of my most admired writers. And I was carrying my Iowa University International Writing Program badge. And she said to me, oh, so you're a writer? And my immediate reaction was to say no. And so it's a difficult reality to grasp when it's something that's so hard to do and something that I have been avoiding, really, for a long time.
What do you think your mentor has done for you so far? I realize you have a great deal of work to do together in the future, but what do you think you've learned from her so far?
She so far has taught me two things. The first thing is to be true to my voice. She and I have had discussions about language, because I wrote the piece that I submitted for the program. I wrote in English, which is not my mother tongue. And we've had all these discussions about whether I should write in English or in Spanish. And, if finding your voice as a writer is a difficult thing to do, then trying to do so when you're having doubts about language is even harder. And I actually submitted my first draft to her this morning, and she and I discussed about, you know, the emotion that comes with your mother tongue or not. And in the end, I discovered that my voice for this text is in English, because writing in Spanish completely broke me. It is my mother tongue, and it is my emotional tongue, and it is the language in which all of this happened. So in the end, the conclusion is that I have to write it in English because it allows me a little bit more distance from my own experience. But the other thing she's taught me is to be relentless. I think that if I weren't with her and I didn't, if I didn't feel responsible to her through the program, I could easily give up. I think probably the first time I sat down, finished writing two pages and sobbed for an hour, I could have easily said, I'm done. But I can't say I'm done. I am responsible to her and I'm responsible to the program. And just knowing that if I have to go through this, hard as it is, but if I'm going through this with her, holding my hand and reading my texts and giving me feedback and helping me avoid pitfalls and being better, then I won't give up. Not at all.
Listening to you talk about how powerful this relationship has already been, it's moving to hear. And Yvonne, I would love to find out what's going through your mind. I mean, I know you have these powerful relationships with your mentees, but listening to Paula talk about how important her mentor has already been to her, what does that make you feel?
Slightly intimidated, frankly. The understanding that the dreams of the precious dreams of another human being very much in your hands too. A sense of responsibility and also a sense of humility, and to just you know, I'm listening to Paula and I'm thinking, oh my, this is serious. This is a dream. This is a dream of another human being that one has been entrusted with. And I listen to Paul and I think, okay, this is now my own new recommitment to walking with my mentees, walking with these young and amazing women to the destination to which they aspire.
Well, I can't wait to see what comes out of these collaborations. It's exciting to hear this strength and inspiration being shared across borders. Yvonne Athiambo Awor, novelist and essayist from Kenya, author of Dust and the Dragonfly Sea. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Charity. Thank you.
And Paula Silva on the line with us from Colombia today, working on her memoir about her experiences as a survivor of abuse and as a single mother. Paula, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Charity.
And best of luck to you. We've been talking about the new Women's Creative Mentorship Project, part of the Iowa or the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, a new way to inspire and support emerging women writers around the world. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.